Hi, and you're in the Philosopher's Zone. We know that strong emotions can divide us, so best to banish them from the public square. That's not so straightforward, according to Martha Nussbaum. She's been called the philosopher of feelings, for whom politics and emotions do go together. In this two-part in-depth conversation, she talks to Scott Stevens about the need to feel.
If nothing else, the 20th century has taught us all to be very wary of emotions. In ethics, emotions suggest irrationality or an unseemly sentimentalism. In politics, emotions are the tool of populists and panderers, of demagogues and dictators. But you know, for someone like Aristotle, right down to Jean-Jacques Rousseau and even Adam Smith, to neglect the emotions is to distort the political sphere beyond all recognition. It's little wonder, then, that one of the greatest living interpreters of Aristotle should have set her sights on reclaiming the emotions for the moral life. From the very beginning, Martha Nussbaum has sought to understand the content and the value of powerful emotions like love, fear, guilt, disgust, and hope. So what was it that first convinced her that emotions are both necessary and neglected objects of consideration?
I guess it was the general interest that I've always had in human vulnerability. That is, the normative question of what forms of vulnerability are good and connected with important goods such as love and friendship. What forms of vulnerability are so damaging that we should try to use just political institutions in order to prevent them, such as hunger, sexual violence, and so on. So that's been the unifying thread. And what I found in Aristotle, perhaps, but even more in the Greek and Roman Stoics, was this idea that what is distinctive about all the emotions as a family is that they all involve the ascription of very high importance and normative value to things outside ourselves that we don't control. So grief involves the thought that someone or something really important to you has gone. Well, of course, if you don't think that anything outside your own reason and will has great importance, you're not going to have that emotion. And so that's what the Stoics wanted you to do, is to, you know, prune all those unwise attachments. But we could reject their normative view about those being unwise and still be extremely fascinated and basically convinced by the detail of their theory of how fear, grief, love, anger, hope, all of these revolve around this initial ascription of worth and value to someone outside yourself. So Epictetus, the Stoic philosopher, imagines having a little talk with Medea, what went wrong in your life, and he says, you know, you should not have loved your husband, and then everything else would have been fine. So it's this initial idea that some child, some person, some country is really, really important, but of course you don't control that leads you in turn to all of these emotions. You know, fear for the beloved object if it's in danger, hope that it will do well, anger when someone else damages it or maybe when it damages you. So that was the core. And initially, I just wanted to pursue that as an ethical insight. And I did feel that it was a neglected area. In the Anglo-American tradition, there were really two people who caused that neglect, and those two are Hume and William James. Basically, the takeaway that the profession got from their writings was that emotions are just feelings. They have no cognitive content at all. And so, a fortiori, they don't have any evaluative content. For Hume, a passion is an original existence, just doesn't contain any intentionality or thought about the world. And for James, in this very odd theory he has, emotions are just forms of awareness of a bodily change. So anyway, both of those people, singly and in combination, were enormously influential. And therefore, people just didn't think that was a philosophical topic. In fact, psychologists didn't think that it was a psychological topic. In fact, psychologists in the heyday of William James-inspired behaviorism felt that all of this talk of emotions would just drop away as old-fashioned folk psychology when we really got the right stimulus-response account. And there were people who fought against that. I would particularly want to mention Anthony Kenney in his wonderful book, Action, Emotion, and Will, and a dear friend of mine, George Pitcher, who wrote a wonderful article in the Proceedings of the Aristotelian Society, advancing already in 1980 a cognitive theory of emotions. But those were voices crying in the wilderness, and so I felt, well, good thing to do is to try to mine the theories of the Stoics for what they can offer us and see where we can go from there.
I wonder where John Rawls came into your thinking about the emotions. Because, I mean, a lot of people would have overlooked this, but his theory of justice contained a rather surprising and, I suppose, in many ways, quite prescient account of the emotions.
I actually didn't in the early stage, for the simple reason that I was working on ethics, not political philosophy. And so, although Rawls was my colleague and I had enormous admiration for his work, I didn't really study it closely until the time around 1982, 83, when I began turning my attention to political philosophy. But of course, you're right in that often neglected third part of the theory of justice. He has a wonderfully rich theory of emotions, and it's a very general theory, but I think he always made it clear that there was some such theory that we would need because there was an important part of the political project, namely ensuring the stability and replication over time of just institutions that we could not accomplish without paying attention to emotions and thinking about how to cultivate them in a way that makes them supportive of just political institutions and not subversive.
There is a tension here, isn't there? Because for emotions to be supportive of just political institutions, as you just said, the emotions themselves do have to undergo a kind of migration, don't they? From family and community and nation, basically people like us, to more universal moral principles, principles like common humanity, equal dignity, economic equality.
I don't think he really faced up to it. I think he thought that emotions could start with particular parents, because he always had this rather middle-class view of the nuclear family, which he seemed to think that in all times and places would be the basic form of social organization. From there, he suggests that through gratitude, we could reach outward and eventually end up with principle-dependent emotions in which the particular would basically drop away. Now, he doesn't exactly say that, but that's the picture that he suggests. And I think that just isn't quite the way people are. I actually think that emotions will not do the job that he assigns to them, namely underwriting the stability of just institutions, unless we can find a way to keep the energy of particular love and the kind of quasi-erotic character of that particular love, which Rawls certainly did not draw attention to, around in the emotions that we have about political causes and political institutions. And so that was what I set out to do in my book, Political Emotions, is to just think that through and think how we could harness the energy of particular love while getting rid of its tendencies to bad kinds of populism, destructive excess, and so on. Now, of course, no one thinks that because beliefs can be led astray by irresponsible politicians, therefore we should get rid of all beliefs in the political sphere. No one ever says that. And I think it's because people already mistrust emotions and they feel that's too messy, maybe too female or something, that they tend to think that way about emotions. Because they can go wrong, then we should just get rid of them all. But in any case, I think that's just as wrong about emotions as it is about beliefs. Sure, they can go wrong. But then what we have to do is figure out how they should go right. And so what I set out to do is to try to go back into the psychology of childhood to figure out what the resources in the personality are, what the obstacles in the personality are, and try to figure out how we could construct a politics that would harness those to a good political conception. And I never wanted to lose hold of the fact that we need attachments to institutions and principles. But I think what we really ought to be aiming at is a dialogue between our attachments to institutions and something that's more particularistic, attachments to geographical features, to historical personalities, and so these things, which of course could be quite unreliable, but if you are a master of political rhetoric, such as Martin Luther King Jr.,
then you can harness them in the right way. If you think about the end of King's I Have a Dream speech, you know, let freedom ring. And then he lists all these places, which are sites of emotion. And they're characterized in quite an erotic way. The curvaceous slopes of California, the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, and so on. And, you know, so he knew how to harness the erotic to the institutional and the just. And that's the kind of project that I think every good entrepreneur of political justice needs to undertake. But of course, it's got to be done in each time and place in its own framework.
This opens up, though, the fraught topic of patriotism. Because, of course, patriotism is necessary to harness the political emotions, to anchor them in our common life, even if that means appealing to an idealized past or appealing to outright historical fictions, which, let's face it, Martin Luther King Jr. was able to do with tremendous effect. But patriotic sentiment is also riddled with all sorts of exclusionary dangers. So I guess I've got to ask, can we have the one without the other?
Yeah. Well, the first question we need to ask is the just political order one that contains nation states or not? Now, Rawls never asked that, and I think that was a mistake in a way because
it really was more of an assumption on his part than anything else.
It was an assumption. And like Kant, he thought that the just world order would consist of a federation of basically just states. But in the modern world, we do have to ask that question. And I actually think the best answer was already given in the 17th century by Grotius, who said, look, the nation has a moral content, which is it's a place where people give themselves laws of their own choosing. And so it's a necessary expression of human autonomy. Now, of course, there might be some larger body that would have those properties of accountability to people's voices, of sufficient expressiveness of their autonomy. And after all, the U.S. Came together first as a collection of states and then became a federated nation. So it wasn't obvious in the beginning that it would be a federated nation that would play that role. But it has to be a nation that somehow or other puts itself together and tells a single story. Ernst Renan, in his great lecture, What is a Nation, that he gave in the 1890s, said that a nation is really a spiritual principle. It's not a thing. And what it is basically a story of what we have endured together and what we're willing to stay together for. So it's about past, but past in the light of the future. So thinking about ourselves, we have to think, why are we together? What do we want to stay together for? And then we tell this story of past struggles in a particular way, in a way that accents what we want to stay together for. I just saw Hamilton in New York. Great retelling of the story of America. And it is fascinating that, of course, it's a terrible lie of a king like Seward to say, here are all these Hispanic and African-American actors, and they are Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson and George Washington. Yeah, I mean, it's a spectacular lie in a way. But at another level, it's not a lie at all, because it's that energy of diversity, of rebelliousness, of not being willing to sit still. So I think, of course, that's partly based on true facts, and it is very closely based on Ron Chernow's wonderful biography of Hamilton. But of course, it's a selective fabrication of spectacular falsity in some respects, but quite wonderful, and I would say essential in this time we're living in.
Martha Nussbaum with Scott Stevens, the first of a two-part in-depth conversation here on The Philosopher's Zone.
Martha, the way that you've been describing Hamilton strikes me as a kind of rousing rebuke to that presumption that's very, very common among the left, that patriotic sentiment or verve is basically destructive to one's wider commitments or universal values. You know, progressive politics, it seems to me, has almost painted itself into a corner by invariably falling back on abstract principles like justice or rights or inclusiveness, or even just by making its appeal to economic self-interest. I mean, we've seen in the recent Brexit debate just how ineffective those kind of abstract appeals were, that the idea of the EU or of a common market just didn't hold the same passionate attachment with people as the idea of an idealized Britain did.
Well, I think that Europe starts at a disadvantage because for so many years, I mean centuries, their conception of what a nation is has been based on ethnicity and language. Whereas, let's say, in Australia, in the U.S., in India, all the Commonwealth countries, I would say the conception of a nation is much more centered around political ideals, political institutions, and no one has ever suggested that immigrants weren't part of that project, because these are nations basically of immigrants, or in the case of India, people who came together in with many, many different languages in many different ways. So I think Europe had an undoing job to do, and they would have to say, look, we have to rethink what it is to belong. And I'm afraid that the project of the EU was understood as primarily economic, only secondarily about political accountability. So I think they had to do a lot more work than they actually did to make clear to people, or to set things up in a way where people felt that there was sufficient political accountability. I mean, after all, people feel aggrieved when Brussels decides something that bears on them, because they feel that's not them. Their voices weren't really sufficiently heard, where, of course, federal governments all the time in the U.S., in Australia, in India, make decisions that bear on people in this or that region. But somehow or other, those people have accepted that form of political authority because they understand that it represents them and hears their voices. But then the third thing that Europe didn't try to do at all is this emotional thing that I'm talking about. There's no sense of a common European story, common European patriotism that would rise above and unite the different patriotisms of the different regions. Now, of course, it's more difficult than it was with the U.S. because you have the different languages. Of course, the U.S. Did have Native American languages, but they didn't acknowledge that until much more recently. The U.S. did have a common language that all these different immigrants spoke, but India did not have that. And yet, India survives with all of its strains as a remarkably successful emotional unity, where people, even the people who are the losers, feel great loyalty to the idea of the Indian nation. It's, you know, very moving to me, because I see the grave injustices, for example, done to Muslims and Christians in India. And one time I remember I was there at the time of a cricket match between India and Pakistan. And all my Muslim friends, I expected them to be rooting for Pakistan because they were so disgruntled, and rightly, about the horrible carnage against Muslims that had been wrought in Gujarat. But no, I mean, they were horrified by the very idea that you would be rooting for Pakistan. They have a deep loyalty to an idea of India, and it was really Gandhi, Nehru, and Ambedkar who forged that in their different ways. And Gandhi was a great master of symbolic politics. He had to deal with people who couldn't understand each other at all linguistically, but he used music, he used his own body, he used all kinds of symbolic appeals to forge that unity. And for all that I admire Angela Merkel, I think she's never devoted very much thought to that question. You know, if Europe is going to survive, it will be as a federated nation, but then they have to think what that is and what kind of work, both political and emotional, that requires.
I'd like to conclude, though, by asking you about the formation of the emotions. I mean, you've long been very optimistic that the emotions can, in fact, be chastened and fashioned and formed and redirected towards mutually beneficial, truly good, inclusive ends. And yet, you know, Martha, we are lacking so many of the resources that have been necessary for the formation of the emotions. Things like a symbolically rich sense of history, things like public art and ritual. Now, this is a problem, it seems to me, and I'm not sure it's a problem that's easily overcome.
I think that we have to think at two levels. There's the developmental, psychological, and then there's the social. And I think by now no one thinks that emotions are just hardwired. I think everyone thinks that they are developed by the kind of care we receive in the family, by the kind of history we have as individuals. And I think at some level everyone also agrees that what kind of society we're in, what conceptions of masculinity and a good man, a good woman, what conceptions of honor and shame and so on, these all shape the emotions that people feel. So I looked at research on compassion and research on disgust, and I said, look, we know by now that the personality has strong
capacities that lead it in the direction of compassion, because from a very young age we have the ability to take up the perspective of another person. But typically, it's developed very narrowly. The compassion we grow to have is only for our family or our local social group. So there's a real challenge, because compassion seems very good, but it could actually be quite bad if it just leads you to care intensely about your own local group and not about anyone else. So that marks a terrain of political work that needs to be done. How would we make the whole nation and all of its people objects of our compassion? But at the same time, there are baneful tendencies that have to be overcome. And here I draw on work that I and others have done for a long time about disgust at the body. Because we're so uneasy, unlike all the other animals, about being embodied, because we hate death, we hate decay, we then come to hate our own bodily fluids. Often, and I would say in every society this happens, we project that discomfort onto some vulnerable subgroup and we say, these are the animals, these are the smelly ones, these are the ones you better steer clear of. And so that very pernicious tendency, whether it's manifested in prejudice against gays and lesbians, what I'm working on right now is prejudice against people who are aging, and believe me, that's a disgust phenomenon that transcends all particular cultures and seems to be present even in young children, unfortunately. You know, there are all these stigmas that need to be overcome, and then how would we do that? So then the question is, how do we do it in our own time and place? Because you can't just say, well, we should have some kind of artwork that tells us a nice story. But then I use very concrete examples of people who have done this well in their own time and in their own place. For example, Rabindranath Tagore, the Indian thinker, philosopher, educator, choreographer, who created dance dramas in his school that showed people that the body and its sensuous capacities were not objects of disgust, but were actually objects of love. He drew on a subculture called the Bowels of West Bengal, who were a marginalized group who actually had an initiation ritual that required you to taste all the fluids of the body, or you couldn't be a member of that group. And so he was drawing on this rich tradition of how you overcome disgust. So that's an example far from my time and place, but then there's one that's very close to home, and that is Millennium Park in Chicago. I don't know how many people in your audience have been there, but it's one of the great public artworks, I would say, of the 21st century. It contains a number of different parts, but the one that I would like to focus on here is the Crown Fountain, designed by Jaume Plensa, which has these large screens which have at any given time pictures of two citizens of Chicago, always of different races, different ages, and so on. And they're very huge and they move in slow motion. So it's funny, because for one of them to raise an eyebrow might take 5 minutes, and that itself is funny. And then between the two screens is this shallow pool. So people wade into the shallow pool because they know that at the end of the 5 minutes when that character is on the screen and the picture is about to change, a jet of water will come out as if from the mouth of the picture, and it will spray all over them. So they have people of all ages and races themselves in the water, playing around together, waiting for this jet of water to hit them. My daughter calls it an ejaculatory aesthetic, but I think that's actually quite a good phrase. And it's a real Walt Whitman-esque idea of how you bring people together around a symbol of bodily and sexual mingling. It's the core of American racism, the refusal to share water, drinking fountains, swimming pools, and of course it's all a symbol for sex. And so we get people doing all this water play together, and that's pretty amazing. So I think that's a wonderful example of how in one particular city with its own particular problems, you figure out what the problems are, and then you figure out some clever and, let's hope, partly humorous way to address that, because I think comedy has potential that serious aesthetics doesn't always have.
Martha Nussbaum, in Chicago. Next week, she moves on to anger and why now, more than ever, we need to get our heads around it. She's in conversation with Scott Stevens, editor of ABC Religion and Ethics Online. Thanks today to Diane Dean and Michelle Watts. I'm Joe Gelonesi.